TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Trump's golf visit. Chaz Freeman explains the U.S.-Israel golf shift. An interview by Jyotisman Mudiyar on the channel India and Global Left. Why did Donald Trump visit the Gulf in May 2025? What does it reveal about shifting U.S.-Israel Gulf relations? Ambassador Chaz Freeman is a veteran U.S. diplomat and Middle East expert. He's being interviewed by Jyotisman Mudiyar, a PhD research scholar at the University of Chicago. From Saudi Arabia and the UAE to Israel and Iran, Chaz Freeman analyzes the power plays, diplomatic deals, and regional tensions shaping today's geopolitics. The conversation took place on May 15, 2025, and lasted over an hour. Here are excerpts, including an excellent bio of Ambassador Freeman by Jyotisman.
Let me welcome former U.S. Ambassador Charles Freeman. Ambassador Freeman is an American retired diplomat and writer. He served in the United States Foreign Service, the State and Defense Departments in many different capacities over the course of 30 years. Most notably, he worked as the main interpreter for Richard Nixon during his 1972 China visit and served as the U.S. ambassador to Saudi Arabia from 1989 to 1992. Ambassador Freeman, welcome back to India and Global Left.
I'm glad to be with you.
Much of the U.S. press has been busy talking about President Trump's visit to the three Gulf states of Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. There is a lot to discuss there, from the U.S. need to find economic allies to the Gulf states' own ambition to emerge as leaders in the region, which brings us to U.S. relationship with both Israel and Iran. But if you could just start with your first impression about how you are reading this visit of President Trump in the Gulf states.
Well, this is a repetition of the first Trump term, when the first foreign countries that he visited were also in the Gulf, Saudi Arabia. And I think it's explained by the nature of Mr. Trump. He's interested in two things, money and real estate development. And as you may recall, the famous bank robber, Willie Sutton, when he was apprehended by the Federal Bureau of Investigation, was asked why he robbed banks. And he said, that's where the money is. And the Gulf is where the money is. It's also where a great deal of real estate development is. While he's looking at magnificent construction sites there and talking about exchanges of investment, the Israelis are completing the demolition of Gaza in a most horrible manner, and nobody's doing anything about that. He also, of course, in the Gulf, will have talked to the leaders, to Mohammed bin Salman and others in Riyadh, because there was a gathering of the Gulf countries there. He will have talked to them about his negotiations with Iran. I think he really wants to have a rapprochement with Iran. He wants to be the one to make peace with Iran. Iran has been aggrieved for almost 75 years, and the United States similarly for about 45 years since the hostage taking during the Islamic Revolution of 1979. This is a long-standing relationship of mutual animosity. It doesn't serve the interests, frankly, of either country. And the issues have been pushed by the Prime Minister of Israel, Mr. Netanyahu, primarily around the Iranian nuclear program, which he alleges is aimed at building a bomb. The intelligence services in the United States and in Israel both say that Iran has made no such decision. However, Iran, after the nuclear deal, which controlled Iranian enrichment and subjected it to rigorous inspection, was undone by Mr. Trump in his first term in office. Iran did begin to reprocess uranium to ever higher levels, and it now has enough uranium enriched to the 60% level to be able to build, we're told, about 6 bombs in a matter of days, not weeks or months, because the next step to weapons grade is very short, and Iranian centrifuges are now very efficient. So there is a reason to try to bring this animosity and the issue of the nuclear proliferation that Iran might present to an end. Unmentioned in all this, of course, is the fact that Israel developed a clandestine nuclear arsenal of considerable size. The Iranians have prepared for the war that Prime Minister Netanyahu has long sought to foment with the United States by putting their weaponry and their nuclear sites deep underground, so deep that, in the judgment of military experts, they could not be destroyed except with a nuclear attack. This is a very dangerous moment. Mr. Trump in Riyadh said several important things. He said the United States had no permanent enemies. He said he wanted to reach a peaceful resolution of differences with Iran. But he also reiterated the military threat. That military threat was symbolized by the deployment of B-52 bombers and B-2 bombers to Diego Garcia. The B-52s appear to be gone. I don't know about the B-2s. But the negotiations are proceeding by fits and starts, mostly in Muscat, Oman. The Omanis have become invaluable mediators between Iran and the United States. There is a serious effort being made by Mr. Trump's personal envoy, someone who has no constitutional or legal status, Stephen Witkoff, his crony in real estate operations in New York, to reach closure. Mr. Witkoff entered this issue with no background in it. He is a skilled negotiator, but new to diplomacy. He appears to be learning and listening. He is obviously talking to Mr. Trump. And I think what the Iranians are offering is a return to the pre-JCPOA, Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, agreement level of enrichment, which is 3.67%. That is enough to fuel reactors and generate power, which Iran has a perfectly legitimate requirement for, but not enough to build a bomb. And the question then is, who will Mr. Trump listen to? Because his administration is clearly divided into America firsters, like the Vice President, J.D. Vance, and Israel firsters. And the Israeli demand is quite extreme. They demand that Iran eliminate all enrichment, even for peaceful purposes. They demand that Iran destroy all its missiles and disarm itself. They demand that Iran cease supporting the resistance to their enlargement of their borders and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. And I don't think Iran can possibly accept these demands. But they were put forward by Mike Waltz, who was just fired as the National Security Advisor. They've been espoused by Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State. There is a faction in the Senate, Lindsey Graham and Tom Cotton and others, who appear to endorse these extreme demands. So it's very hard to say what will happen. But I do think Mr. Trump, to go right back to your original question, I apologize for the length of my answer, but this is a very complex situation. Mr. Trump will have found in Riyadh and Doha that the situation in the Gulf has radically changed. Whereas in his first term, he was promoting the Abraham Accords, which were the nucleus of a proposed anti-Iranian coalition between the Gulf Arabs and Israel. Israel has now achieved hegemony in the Levant, and there is an incipient move between the Gulf Arabs and Iran to form a coalition to balance Israel. That is, a coalition against Israel to balance its territorial and other ambitions. So there has been a rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran, which had been mortal enemies in the past. The Saudi defense minister, Khalid bin Salman, the son of the king and the brother of the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, has been in Tehran speaking with not only his counterpart, the defense minister, but also with the supreme leader, Khamenei. So things are in flux. They are not what they were. And I'm sure that Mr. Trump will have heard in Riyadh and in Doha cautions from his hosts against a war with Iran, because they have absolutely no desire to be involved in such a thing and are effectively deterred by the Iranian announcement that they will attack Saudi Arabia or Qatar or UAE or any other country in the Gulf that aids and abets an American warfare on the Islamic Republic. So this is a very complicated situation. Everything is up in the air. We don't know what will happen. A great deal depends, as I said, whether Mr. Trump is true to his America First agenda or whether he embraces the Israel First agenda of the majority of his advisors.
Do you think President Trump's decision to upend the global trade order in particular, but it also has serious ramifications for the financial order, has made the United States more dependent on the Gulf states in West Asia, given his inability to strike concrete deals with Europe and Canada, and given it seems his continuation of hostilities with China? The United States does need alternative, reliable economic partners. And one of the suggestions is that the Gulf states have money, although a lot of times that money is exaggerated. Saudi Arabia, for instance, is now running a deficit. It has borrowed already 30% of its GDP. And with the oil prices down, it doesn't have a lot of money to pump. So there are lots of questions by Bloomberg and others about the $1 trillion pledge that they have made without giving us any detail. But it is also true that the deals of Boeing, for instance, in Qatar, Boeing has been going through a very rough phase, starting with the accident, but also long year-long strikes. And it seems that they desperately need these deals, which was further more hurt by the trade deals. And then it's the same with the capital markets, with a lot of South Korean and Japanese money flowing out of the U.S. bond market, and the treasury market is not doing well. You need the sovereign funds in Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis to pump in more money into the U.S. capital markets, including the stock markets. Do you think that's a reasonable line of argument to say that the United States is looking to pivot towards West Asia now? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, that's a very complicated question. Let me say, I don't think that the drive to absorb investment from Saudi Arabia and others is driven by the ridiculous tariff tantrum that the United States has had. I'll talk about that in a minute, but I want to say that I think there is an expectation, there is an exaggeration, if you will, of the wealth of the Gulf. It is one of two places where there is substantial capital available. The other is China. The United States has written off China for that purpose, foolishly in my view, but at any rate we have. And so if you want to prop up treasuries, if you want to help Boeing recover from its own mismanagement and make sales, this is a logical place to do it. And Boeing, of course, is a victim of two things. First, its own lapse into financial capitalist management rather than the engineering culture that previously prevailed. It has engaged in financial engineering, not real engineering, and that has taken its toll on the quality of the product. Second, the Chinese had suspended the delivery of previous orders of aircraft. They've now, in response to Mr. Trump's rollback of the tariffs, they have allowed the deliveries to proceed, but they're not placing new orders. So, yes, this is very important to Boeing, very important to the United States Treasury, it's very important to Mr. Trump. Having said all of that, the $1 trillion figure is a mirage. These are common in deserts, I know, and it's very unlikely that anything resembling that figure will emerge in the form of transactions. This is a vague statement of intent, or perhaps not even intent, aspiration, or perhaps puffery. It is not a serious number. Then we have the problem you mentioned, that actually the Saudis in particular are somewhat strained financially. They have a budget that requires a higher oil price than the one that now prevails. Mr. Trump's
almost double.
Yes, that's right.
From 62 to 113, I'd like Bloomberg calculations.
Rather than 60, which is what the current price is. So they are, in fact, curtailing some of the more extravagant projects that they had embarked upon, or if not curtailing them, at least delaying them. This is not the cornucopia that some people in Washington evidently imagine. The other thing that is important about this, however, is that, as I think you indicated in the opening part of your question, this is an example of the increased importance, agency, and independence of the Gulf states. This is a phenomenon that is occurring globally as the great power rivalry and the deference to great powers that characterized the previous era attenuate. We see middle-ranking powers, smaller countries, gain freedom of maneuver, diversify their relationships. In Latin America, this is characterized by some important writers as active non-alignment. That is an active balancing act between powerful countries. And this is happening in the Gulf. And so there's a need to compete here, the United States feels, with other countries, China in particular, India, Russia, some European countries, who have basically displaced American hegemony economically in the region. This is a logical target for Mr. Trump. And as I said, he likes money and he likes real estate development. And that's where these things are present.
The Gulf states are also increasing their contacts with Russians and the Chinese. Of course, they have had a good and growing relationship with India for a while as well. So it's not that they're putting all their basket in the United States.
No, they won't. They learned long ago, as this century began, and certainly after 2011, when the Arab uprisings occurred and Hosni Mubarak and others were removed from office, so that American protection goes only so far, and that they did need to diversify their relationships. Their relationship with both Russia and China is relatively new. They had a relationship with neither until the Gulf War of 1990-91, made the establishment of relations necessary to retain UN Security Council support. But they've developed these relationships very extensively. China is now the largest trading partner for Saudi Arabia. It is a major commercial presence in the UAE also. It is a major purchaser of Qatari oil and gas. And of course, it has a very good relationship with Iran. And it has parlayed this into a mediation that produced rapprochement between Riyadh and Tehran, which I referred to. The Russians actually had, the Soviet Union had relations with the kingdom until in the 1930s, when they were broken off. They were restored during the Gulf War of 1990-91. They too have led to a major partnership with OPEC plus one, working quite effectively to regulate oil prices to the extent that any cartel can. So, you're correct. I think the relationship with India is also relatively new, except, of course, in terms of the Indian expatriate labor, Indian and Pakistani, South Asian, also Sri Lankan, that is ubiquitous in the Gulf. This is very important to India and to Pakistan and Sri Lanka because of the remittances that the labor force sends home, and also because of the skills in handling modern equipment and modern banking facilities and so forth that Indians, Pakistanis in particular, acquire from working in the Gulf.
You said something very important, that the situation has changed from 2017, 2018, in the sense that genocide and ethnic cleansing in Gaza has significantly, and the weakening of Hezbollah in South Lebanon. One can also add the fall of Damascus to ulcera to that soup. And that means that Israel's strategic power has significantly increased in the region, which has meant that the rapprochement between Iran and the Gulf states have become all the more reasonable. And I think Yemen was an important piece here, because when the offensive, U.S. offensive started, there was a lot of talks in the U.S. media, particularly at Foreign Affairs, that this might go in the direction of a ground invasion. Of course, with the support of UAE and Saudi Arabia to back the IRG against the Houthis. I mean, these are fantasies, but these talks were there. And now the sudden withdrawal of the United States, not to mention that they didn't even involve a clause on truce with Israel, makes it very clear that the Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis, they are completely clear that they don't want to get into the mess in Yemen once more. I mean, they would have preferred the IRG over the Yemenis, but they know that they can't do much about it. And it's better to do a deal with Iran, which to my mind says that the bombing option is over. The very aggressive containment of Iran is over. Of course, this is not to say that some containment of Iran would not be there. That would definitely be there. Can you talk more about this dynamic that is evolving but is also very unclear?
There are very important trends at work here. Let me start with Syria, where President Trump has removed the sanctions, shaken hands with al-Sharia, who is a man with a horrible past. But he's what we have in Yemen. This is an example of Trumpian realism, I think. But the fact that Israel has devastated Syria and basically deprived it of effective sovereignty and any defense against Israeli transgressions gives Iran and Saudi Arabia a common interest in rebuilding Syria, reconstituting it, perhaps even working with the Turks, who are the major force in Syria, and who are in confrontation with Israel, to assure the reemergence of an independent sovereign Syria, as opposed to the fragmented Syria that Israel has always desired. So this is important. Similarly, we see the Turks apparently willing to aid Hezbollah, despite the fact that it is Shia and was aligned with Iran, and Turkey is adamantly Sunni. So ideological differences are being overcome by reasons of state that apply to geopolitical developments. On the question of Yemen, let me make a couple of observations. First, this illustrates the ability of President Trump to make astonishing misjudgments and equally astonishing corrections of those misjudgments. Because as he ended the savage bombing of Yemen, which I don't think did the United States any good internationally, reputationally, quite the opposite. It simply dramatized the bravery and resolve of the Yemenis to do what the Genocide Convention requires all countries to do, namely oppose genocide. They're the only ones who have actually been willing to put their lives on the line to do that. Mr. Trump praised them for their resolve and steadfastness. And as you indicated, he did not insist that they end the Red Sea blockade against Israel. They will not attack American ships anymore, but they will continue to bombard Israel with missiles on an occasional basis, at least within their capacity. And the land-based sea blockade that they have initiated, which is unprecedented, by the way, will continue. So any vessel proceeding to or from Israel or carrying goods in the direction of Israel or owned by the Israelis will be subject to attack. So in addition to illustrating Mr. Trump's ability to recognize errors and change his mind and the policy, this is part of a broader pattern in which the United States appears to be declaring a measure of independence from Israeli guidance. So we have the issue of Syria, which I mentioned, going against the Israeli government's desire for a fragmented, prostrate Syria. Apparently, Mr. Trump wants to see Syria reconstituted and rebuilt. The issue of a ceasefire in Gaza is now a matter of contention. First, both because Mr. Witkoff initially negotiated a ceasefire with Israel and Hamas, and Israel subsequently broke that agreement. I think Mr. Witkoff is now aware that there's a regular pattern of Israeli disregard for commitments that it has made. And now we have an issue where Mr. Trump says there will be humanitarian aid delivered to Gaza by Americans under American supervision, not Israeli. And in the meantime, the Israelis are building distribution centers that the Israeli military proposes to operate. So we're at odds there. And then there's the issue of Yemen, where Israel was not informed about the negotiations and was not included in the result. And finally, we have the Trump visit to the region for the first time, excluding a drop-in on Israel, going to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates only. These are very important indicators of some degree of distancing between the Trump administration on an America First basis and the government of Israel. How far this will go is impossible to predict because the domestic Zionist lobby is so powerful. We see, for example, members of that or beneficiaries of that lobby financially in the Senate, Lindsey Graham, Tom Cotton in particular, arguing against a deal with Iran, obviously encouraged to do that by the lobby, which is, despite being unregistered, a foreign policy arm of the Israeli government. This is a very interesting development. How far it will go, we don't know, but it reflects Mr. Trump's aversion to being manipulated. And Mr. Netanyahu is the manipulator par excellence of American politics, and he's publicly declared that. I don't think Mr. Trump enjoys being manipulated.
You heard an interview of Ambassador Chaz Freeman by Jyotisman Mudiyar. He's a PhD research scholar at the University of Chicago. Freeman is a veteran U.S. diplomat and Middle East expert. And Jyotisman is co-founder of the YouTube channel India and Global Left. They spoke on May 15, 2025. And you can watch their inspired conversation on YouTube under the title Trump's Gulf Visit. Chaz Freeman explains the U.S.-Israel Gulf Shift. Deep dive into Middle East. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gilardin. Thank you for listening.